ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. This place is what you make of it, because it's an environment, it's kind of a habitat. Did you get the bag? It's a habitat. Every species needs a specific habitat in order to survive. And spiritual entities also need a spiritual environment in order to survive. It's very difficult for a spiritual being to survive in a... in a materially charged atmosphere. And so this is a... considered an oasis, a place where anyone can come and drink as deeply as he or she wishes from the spiritual water that we have here, which it comes really in the form mostly of sound vibration. Because what distinguishes a material environment from a spiritual environment has to do with the sound that's pulsating through the airwaves. And by that same theory, one can also transform one's own environment. It's not necessary to come to a centrally located place, although it really helps, because you'll meet advanced people there, advanced spiritual practitioners. And when you hear from advanced spiritual practitioners and see them, then you'll also become encouraged. However, the science of spiritual life has to be applicable everywhere, because the idea of spirit is that it comes from one common source. In fact, everything comes from one common source. And Krishna speaks about this in the Bhagavad Gita when he says, Aham sarvasya pravavo, Matak sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante imam buddha bhava samanvitaha. He says, everything emanates from me, and those who come to know about this engage in my service with all their hearts. They become fully dedicated. They know where everything comes from. And in the science of Krishna consciousness, we learn that both material and spiritual energies, which are listed as categorically different from one another, material energy can also be transformed into spiritual energy. And a good example of how this can take place, of how energy is transformable, is in an iron bar. When you place an iron bar within fire and you leave it there, then it becomes hotter and hotter, and then it becomes fire-like. There's no difference between fire and what used to be the bar. So in a similar way, by introducing some basic principles, spiritual principles, into one's life, wherever one lives or works, one will transform the environment. All of the originally material atoms and sound vibrations and molecules of one's body will, like that iron bar, become fire-like or spiritualized. And the root cause of that happening, of transformation in spiritual life, is sound, because sound carries consciousness. We notice regularly when people speak to us that we detect their consciousness from their speech. If we listen in carefully, in fact, sometimes when people live together for various reasons, either they're in the same ashram or they're, you know, spouses, you can detect a person's consciousness even though they'll say the same words. You might say, oh, I detected something else. Even from far away on the telephone, the way someone hesitates by a fraction of a second, or just the tone of their voice, will indicate something about their consciousness. You may say, they said, no, that's what I said. And you said, yeah, but your tone was different. I detected something. In fact, it's amazing how much you can detect. For instance, if you get on a conference call with people you know, and everyone says hello at the same time, you can detect who's on the call. You say, oh, that's this one, this one, this one. In your mind's eye, immediately, you'll manifest the faces and forms of those people. In a similar way, Narada Muni talks in the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, about how the mantra, iti murtyabhidhanena mantra murtim amurtikam, yajite purusham samyag sad sa samyag darshana puman. He says that to have a vision of the Supreme, the original source of everything, Krishna, is also possible through sound. Iti murtyabhidhanena mantra murtim amurtikam. Murti means a form. So God has a form. And amurtikam means formless. But it also murti also means difficulty. And amurtikam also means without difficulty. So in this verse, iti murti abhidanina, mantra murtim amurtikam, it means that the form of Krishna is easily seen or detected by the use of the mantra. And he says it's not a partial vision, it's not something theoretical, but you actually see it directly for yourself. Sasamyag darshanam puman. He says you actually get the full experience of the Supreme through the mantra, through sound. That's how important it is. And in the Krishna Consciousness Movement, in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, the primary means for anyone to advance is by the practice of imbibing transcendental sound. This word imbibe actually comes from a word which means to drink. The word imbibe means to drink. And you drink, normally, you think of drinking water and so forth through your mouth, although you can have an intravenous drink. They'll hook you up to your vein and go in your vein. But in this case, the bhakti scriptures talk about how you can drink to your full satisfaction and a beverage that actually will transform you spiritually through your ears. It's kind of interesting, almost sounds poetical, how you drink through your ears. But what do you drink? The sound. And the ears are an interesting apparatus anyway, because if you look at them, normally we take it for granted. You look at a famous movie star and you think, oh, they look really good. But if you start looking at their ears really carefully, it's like, actually, they look a little strange. What are ears anyway? They're like satellite dishes on the side of your head. And they're particularly designed with all these channels in them. And you'll notice if you ever wear a hat or something that covers the very tip of your ears, that it's hard to hear everything. I've noticed that on cold days. If I'm in Canada or something, I'm wearing a cap on my head. And then I'm chanting japa. I have to move it above my ears because there's a channel blocked. I can't hear completely. And they're there for a reason. There's a design to these. So the design is so you can either hear, says the Srimad Bhagavatam, about material progress. There are many statements that people will make. In fact, even in the Vedas, there are statements about attaining a more comfortable situation in this world. And you might hear it carefully, and when you drink that sound, it go into your heart and it'll have a particular effect on your life, and then you'll be inspired in a particular way by hearing that. But by hearing spiritual sound vibration, then the Srimad Bhagavatam says, in a beautiful poetical phrase, Satam prasangam mama virya sambido, bhavanti rit karna rasayanakata, taj joshanat ashu apavargavartmini, shada ratir bhaktir anukramishuti, that this hearing of spiritual sound vibration will be the cause of you making step-by-step progress. That sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Step-by-step progress. That's how it usually happens in any discipline. In spiritual life, and it actually names the various categories of advancement. Like Shraddha means that you develop an uncanny sense that by practicing spiritual life, you don't need to do other things. That by, for instance, watering the root of a tree, you water all the branches and leaves automatically. So similarly, by attending first, you may have to do other things. That's practical. But if you attend first, you make the priority, you pay yourself first, your spiritual self first, then all the other aspects of your life will fall into place easily, or a lot more easily. The facility will come from your spiritual practice and not the other way around. Sometimes I may think that first let me get my material life into place, then I'll attend to my spiritual life. Backwards. That's what they call putting the cart before the horse. Now it's a cliche to say cart before the horse, but it's, if you actually take a minute to think of these cliches, they're actually kind of funny. You think of a horse and then you put a cart in front of him and you go, go. So the horse is looking at you. How am I going to go? The cart's in front of me. I pull the cart. So in a similar way, those who are acquainted with the spiritual science, acquainted meaning not just philosophically, but they've experienced for themselves that by just a little investment every day in the spiritual practice, especially hearing spiritual sound vibration, that all the other aspects of their lives become easier to perform. So Krishna consciousness is good not just in an isolated sense for those who are interested in spiritual life. It's not a sectarian process or a traditional religious process that comes by cultural momentum, but it's a practical means through which one can improve one's life on all levels. And it shows how matter is formed by one's consciousness. You can, for instance, look at the state of somebody's house. In fact, I knew somebody could do this. There was a famous, and still is, famous person who became a kind of a celebrity in the field of financial advice. And she wrote many books and has, I think she still has websites and everything. Her name is Suze Orman. And she used to be able to ask people a few questions about their life and then tell them how much money they had. For instance, how organized is your purse? She would ask somebody. And she'd look in the purse and it's all a mess and say, oh, you're probably in debt, you know, and like by this much. And she was accurate in seeing that in people. So there's a way in which when I have a particular kind of consciousness, it will manifest in my outer world as well. And that goes to the point that the way in which we attend to our spiritual practice and the refining of our consciousness will directly translate into a better life externally. By better, I mean one will be a better equipped to deal with whatever situations come up in life. It doesn't guarantee that weird stuff won't happen, because weird stuff happens to everybody. But you will actually have the wherewithal to deal with it. And that's a very high level of living, even in what we call, you know, secular or material life, something that's sought after constantly by people who are pursuing material careers, are looking for advice, how to be more tolerant, how to deal with reverses in life, how to deal with depression, sadness. There's so many ways in which one can be affected by the material world. But if I deal with them individually and try to solve each one of them as they come up, or if I use superficial means to do it, it won't be successful. And this comes up in the Bhagavatam as well. when Shukadeva Goswami is speaking to Maharaj Parikshit about how one can solve the problems of life. And he says that solving the problems of life without attending to one's spiritual practice is like when you burn grass in a field and you think it's all gone. But then when the next rain comes, as we can see very well here in California, everything was burned to a crisp here because all we had was sun and sun and sun and sun and sun for the last 5 years and no rain. And now it's been rain and rain and rain and rain and rain and no sun. And all the burned dry grass was, we called it the golden state. It's actually the burned brown state. It's now green and green and green. Everywhere's green. I didn't even know where I live anymore. I look around. I've never seen it like this my whole life here in California. And that's because it was right below the surface, the seeds were waiting to come up again. And as soon as the rain comes, it comes back up. That's frustrating when it relates to my own life. For instance, I may think that, and I've overcome a bad habit. And then out of the blue, one day when you thought you had a good track record, you've been going for a long time, and all of a sudden, I don't know, I'll use my old example, you find yourself sitting at a table with a half gallon of ice cream and a spoon. And, and it's three-fourths of it is gone, and you look at yourself, you look at the spoon. Like, how'd that happen? I don't even know. It's frustrating. But through spiritual growth, one can actually come to the point of what is called nishta. And interestingly, in English, the Sanskrit word nishta, which means steadiness in spiritual life, has it's cognate to the word stand. We say understand because, you have a place of clarity when you understand something. Or when you stand, you're apparently in a have solid footing. So you can have actual control over your lower self by the practice of spiritual life. And that's important also because making bad decisions based on cravings or developed bad habits can lead to all kinds of situations that one wishes one could take back later but can't. That's also a revelation unto itself. Then you have to wait until you have another opportunity. So it's better to take advantage of all the opportunities one can get while we have the chance in this short human life. And those are available especially to those who prepare themselves spiritually. So what are some of the ways that one can prepare oneself spiritually in life? What are some of the basic activities that really make a difference? I have them all right here in this little book. Actually, not all of them, but I was thinking today about it. I was just thinking there are a few things that you can do that really make a big difference in your life. Right, one of them, here's one. It's highly recommended. This was recommended by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who 500 years ago taught the science of Krishna consciousness all over India. He went around took it upon himself to actually walk from one village to the next, barefoot. He was a sannyasi. This is very simple. He'd come to a town, a village, and he would spend time with some of the leaders there, and he would teach them simple method of practicing spiritual life that everybody in the village could take to. It was not simply for priests or people who had a high birth, but for everybody. Okay, listen to this. We have, let me see. This is serious. We have a Nissan Murano in the parking lot, and it should be moved right away because Radhakripa Prabhu is our enforcer. And I understand he used to be in the military. And he doesn't mess around. So if you have a Murano of any color or kind anywhere near here, I would move it as soon as possible. Unless you don't like it anymore. we'll take it. Yeah, so this practice that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught, it's such a beautiful story, too, of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He walked all the way from the place Jagannath Puri, which is on the east coast of India. And he walked barefoot all the way through jungles and little paths. And he took it upon himself to go from one village to the next with a very simple message. Simple messages can pass on to others. It's something people look at and go, I can do that. That's what he had. He had a simple thing. It wasn't very complicated. And also, he was all-inclusive. He brought everybody in. The way he taught, in fact, there are verses about this. Kiba vipra kiba nyasi shudra kena noi, ye krishna tattva veta she guru hoy. He said, in order to teach this to others, and that's what he was interested in, finding teachers. He was going around and he was identifying people that had some enthusiasm for spiritual life. And he was saying, okay, here's something that comes from a long tradition of scriptural evidence that you can take up. And please, you become a teacher. You teach it to other people. So he wasn't just trying to advertise himself, I'm the only teacher. And you all just become subordinate to me. But he was teaching, you learn how to do this and you help other people by teaching this. So what he did, he went from one village to the next and he taught a simple process. And that was that there are different kinds of vibrations in this world. Some are what he called material vibration and the other are spiritual vibration. And he said, you can pick up that spiritual vibration and you can use it in your own life and then in your village and everything will transform. And one of the ways he taught people to do this is through a mantra. A mantra is compact. It has all the information of the spiritual world within it, just as much as a zip file may have volumes of books, of information within them. And it appears to be one icon on your screen. But when you click on that, and it jumps into your download folder, and all of a sudden, all kinds of folders start opening up, and there's folders within folders. Well, this is a kind of zip file, the mantra itself, that when you open it in your own life, then you'll start to see it opening. All the different categories of spiritual knowledge become available right on the dashboard of your mind and heart. They become readily available to you. You can simply open them and see them for yourself and take advantage. So he taught this, that here's a compact, everything included within this mantra. And then he went around and he taught it to the leaders that he meet, and how he identified leaders by finding people who had a natural enthusiasm for spiritual life. And in the verse I just quoted, Akiba Viprakiba Nyasi Shudra Kenono, he said, at that time in India, people were very caste conscious. It's like, this person can practice spiritual life, this person can't. And so he said, no, that's not the system. System is, it's available to everybody because we're all part of God. And therefore, you don't have to be a priest to practice this. You can. It doesn't matter if you're what they called at that time a shudra. You're just considered to be an insignificant worker. You're also qualified. All you have to have is a little bit of spiritual enthusiasm. If you feel within yourself that, yes, I should do more, I need to satisfy my spiritual hunger, and you're eager for that, you're qualified to take this. And you're also qualified to become a teacher if you just learn how to do it. Learn how that mantra works and a little bit about what's behind it. And when you start practicing it yourself, then you can give it to other people. Well, it's spread like anything. It's such a simple method, and it's so... He had the spiritual acumen to show how it related to all this, the greater body of scriptures of India, because they're vast. The Vedas are, they're unlimited departments of knowledge. So he, although he approached in such a simple way and showed people, he could also, on demand, show exactly how it connected to all the original scriptures, the Vedas, ancient Vedas, and also the more modern version of the Vedas in the Smritis that were written to explain the Vedas. And he showed how it all connected together. For anybody with a little bit of intellectual curiosity and wanted to know how it all worked. And so each village he went to, he would invite people together and he would teach them this simple method, and that was to repeat the mantra. And one of the ways he showed, by personal example, is he would sit in the morning, usually in a serene place like under a tree, and then he would personally chant the names in this mantra. They're names of God. And so the mantra is Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hey, we've heard that before, right? Yeah, it's funny because wherever we go, we're at Google recently and we were teaching this mantra to the employees there. And afterwards, one of the employees came up and goes, you know, I think I've heard this mantra before. This is like George Harrison, 1960-something. It gets around. And so he would teach. You repeat this mantra, and he would show by example. For instance, when he came to Vrindavan, it's well known that he would sit under the Imli tall tree. And he would sit there from early morning till late in the morning, and he would just, for himself, give this prayer over and over again. And the prayer of this mantra is so beautiful. People say it all the time. They don't know they're saying it. Have you ever seen on people text? Or if you walk by a bunch of high school students, I hear this all the time. I live near a high school in Burlingame High School. And so when I take my walk to Washington Park, I go by. Sometimes, like the other day, there was a whole group of girls that were standing there in the corner. And when I went by, they were going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And I was chanting on my beats, and I was thinking, I'm saying the same thing. Because that's what it means. Hare Krishna Rama. It's all vocative. It's all like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And that's all, that's natural for everyone to say, even high school girls. It just kind of comes out naturally. When you see something, you think it's something, you just go. And so he would sit there, and it's such a satisfying way to feed the soul. You know, it's a direct spiritual process. You don't have to include a lot of philosophy. You just have to do what's natural, and that's call out from your heart. Oh, my God. I mean, you can do it out of gratitude. That's a way of saying, oh, my God, that I can't believe how fortunate I am. And another way you can call out is say, I can't believe how much I'm suffering. And who else are you going to call to? You know, there's nobody. You can realize I can't fix this myself, so you can say, oh, my God. How did I get in this situation? And there are many ways in which you can express this feeling. And so he showed that this is universal. It doesn't matter what mood you are in right now. It's applicable because ultimately in the science, we're all part of God. And therefore, it's natural for us being dependent on him and actually having a relationship with him to just have this feeling of calling out. And it doesn't have to be so intellectual to be satisfying, because after all, like a child just knows that the thing that will satisfy me is to be connected with my mother. It's a very simple and sublime thing to see the mother and the child then suddenly connected, and then watch the child satisfied. So there's a satisfaction to, again and again, for oneself, repeating the name over and over again. And then he also taught that the people in the village can come together and they can sit, for instance, in someone's house, maybe in a circle. The kids can be there. Kids, normally, if you sit down and you start talking detailed philosophy. They'll start pulling down the drapes, and then they'll start scratching the floor, because they don't want to hear philosophy, and they don't want you to hear philosophy either. So, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught, if you just chant with a melodious tune and a little rhythm, the kids will come running in and go, this is for us. This is our thing too. And everybody all over the world will be awakened, because rhythm is the universal language. Anywhere you go in the world, if you put up a nice beat, all of a sudden people come along. And I saw it the other day. There was an opening on Burlingame Avenue of a new shop. I have no idea what it is, but I think it has something to do with cosmetic surgery. And outside they had a DJ, and he was cranking out some tunes. And so there was some little kids standing there dancing. They're you know, just local kids. And I saw a lot of locals who are normally strolling down the street. They're looking over. They're attracted to the sound vibration. You know, there's a beat, and some people put a little spring in their step. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also taught that if you take this mantra and you accompany it with some rhythm, then you can stay with it. People, you know, sometimes people, they'll come to concerts and things. They'll be happy to sit there all night long, because it satisfies something in the senses to have rhythm. When you come into an assembly and there's good rhythm, you say, I can stay here a while. Philosophy, maybe after half an hour. He's like, I got to go. My mom's calling me. She needs a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I got to go. But if you got rhythm going on, that's good rhythm, he's like, that's interesting. The mind, the senses, they all... So he said, put the mantra to rhythm. And then he said, you add a little melody. And the melody, even deer, when they hear melody, you can see nowadays, all over Facebook, they have these things. Someone plays the violin and the cows come, the deer come, the birds come, everyone comes. Where's that melody coming from? Violin. It's beautiful. So the same way, add rhythm, melody, then you put the mantra in. Hearts wide open, senses wide open, mantra goes deep inside. Meditation, easy for this age when there's lots of distraction. And so he taught, if you don't have fancy instruments, you can just clap your hands, sit together in the home, and together you sing the mantra again and again. And there's something mystifying about it. There's something about the sound of the mantra that one can't identify with any other sound that one's heard. That's what's so interesting about it. And we have visual evidence. We have photographic proof of this. Even from last Friday, we were filming live when we were at this event down in Palo Alto, which is 22 square miles surrounded by reality. And people would come on their way to somewhere else, and then they'd stop and look. And we have... you know, video of people stopping, and you can see in their eyes, their countenance, they're trying to figure out what the sound is. It's not radio, what they've heard on the radio. It's not any other kind of music that they've heard. There's something about the mantra that's exotic, and it's mystifying, and it puts one almost into a trance. And it's almost like people want to get away, because they're thinking, This is going to do something to me. In fact, when we introduce the mantra to people, sometimes when we meet them on the streets, we'll say, now I'll teach you a mantra. Do you believe in the power of prayer? And they say, normally they say yes, right? Say yes. And they say, and if they say no, then we say, perfect, I'll teach you a mantra. And then so we say, they say yes. And then we say, okay, I'll teach you this mantra. It's from Sanskrit. It's a little hard to pronounce, so I'll say it the first time and you can repeat. You'll know how to do it. Are you ready? Okay, so he says yes, and then say spouse is with Mr. Yes, and spouse goes no, and grabs the arm of the spouse and says, Larry, you're not doing this. And he's like, why? And because we don't know what's in it, and we don't either. We have no idea what's in this mantra. In fact, devotees say that all the time. What is this? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after he got the mantra from his spiritual master, he took initiation into it. He came back and said, my dear Gurudev, did you give me the right thing? Because this is crazy. I mean, what's happening to me now when I chant the mantra? What's in this? And his spiritual master, very good. This is perfect. This is what should happen. It's some joy starts to come out of you that you didn't know what was in there, and it drives you nuts. You go crazy by the mantra. This is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said. So when you hear the sound and you listen to it, your mind will be caught. And this is the perfection of yoga. If you try sitting and staring at a wall, like paint the wall and just wait till the paint dries and just sit there, say, when's it going to dry? You'll start getting distracted. You'll think about what? Shopping. What? To see whether it's dry or not. I mean, there's so many things the mind can catch on to. It's a very sticky world. You know, the things, thoughts come by and go, stick onto that. And the next thing you know is like, that was 2 hours ago. Why am I even doing this? It doesn't make any difference. You know, so the mantra is something centralized that you can catch your mind. And it's almost like when people fish. I see all the time in Japan, people, they're along the side and they cast their lure in the water. And what the lure is, it's a shiny piece of metal. It has hooks all over it. So they throw it in, and they pull it through the water, and it goes like this. And the fish look at it, and they have to do it. I watch them out there. Sometimes they're there for an hour, and they're casting. And finally, the fish goes, okay, I'll take it. And they finally grabs it. I can't stand it anymore. I'm going to take it. And it's like, okay, caught. So the same way, the mind has to be caught as well. You keep putting the mantra out, and it comes by, and the mind's going, nah, 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 and finally, grab. And it grabs, and then it gets caught on the mantra. And we see people also, when they come to our kirtan performances, their minds get caught. And so this is a powerful form of yoga, because the mantra is spiritual, and when you catch it on something, when you catch the mind on something spiritual, then it can be drawn into spiritual life. And your life can become perfect. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught this as the simple means to advance in spiritual life. These two ways: sitting by yourself and chanting, or in a group with others, but you're chanting from your heart outwardly to call Krishna into your life and to be connected to him. And the other way is to get together with groups of people, two or more, and then sing together. And even better, the way it expands, if you do it with family members and friends, it's very powerful. And then if you take it outside and you do it in public places, and this is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also taught, for the first year that he taught the congregational chanting, the group chanting of the mantra, he did it with his closest associates, and they locked the doors of the house, of Srivast Thakur's house, and nobody else could get in. And then after a year, he said, okay, go out and do it outside. And when he did that, then all kinds of things started to happen. And the first of which was somebody called the police, because that's what always happens. And then gradually, it started to transform the whole environment of the city by the chanting process. And then it started spreading, and then went here, there, then all over the universe it can go. It can't be stopped. The vibration is so powerful. So this is a foundational part of the practice of spiritual life as it's been passed down through Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from over 500 years ago. And it's been expounded upon. This simple process has been expounded upon sufficiently so that anyone can look at the philosophy behind it and understand how it's a sound philosophy, how it all works, how all the energies are working and so forth, so that one can also have a philosophical background to appease one's sense of curiosity to continue the process. And there's a few other basic things, but right now I'm just going to take some reflections. That means anything that you heard so far that's stuck in your mind. Navina Narada Prabhu, and then Kanka right behind you.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu. I really like the point about the zip file, that we don't know what's in it. And sometimes, like, you get these attached files, and you're not sure, like, should I click on it or not? Because God knows what's going to happen. So depending on who sends it out,
that's a good point, yeah.
And also there's an access code, like you have Wi-Fi, but sometimes you need a special password in order to access that file. So Mahaprabhu also gave that one. But before you'll tell us what the access code is, I'm amazed to see how, I mean, I don't know how you do it, whether you prepare everything, or I just see how you're putting your heart out to share these realizations with us. So I just wanted to appreciate, because some talks you can kind of guess where it's going, but I'm intrigued to just be part of this group and to see how you're sharing your observations and realizations with us. So thank you for that. Hare Krishna.
Thank you for that. Boy, that was heartfelt, and I deeply appreciate it. I was just thinking when you said that, oftentimes when you download a file from the internet, that at least on a Macintosh system, it asks you, "You sure you want to download this?" It gives you a choice. This came from the internet from an unknown source. Do you want to download it or not? And it's a big thing. Once you push the button, it can have big consequences. So I like that. It took the metaphor a little further. Like, you do want to look into where it came from. Kind of goes to that, right? But I would appreciate it if you would tell the access code, because that wouldn't be an original thought from me. And I know where you're going with it, I think, but I don't want to say it because it'd be a little artificial. You please tell.
No,
expound upon it.
Well, I have heard from authorities that even if you chant the mantra, sometimes you may feel you cannot truly access it. So Mahaprabhu also gave the access code. Trinadapi sunichena tarori vasahishnuna amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. That if we're truly in a humble state of mind, feeling ourselves lower than the grass, the straw in the street, more humble than a tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige and ready to offer respect and service to all others, then we can actually access the true meaning of the mantra.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And it is helpful. Analogies help to build these bridges so that we can get the message in a way that is easily accessible. Kanka.
That was perfect. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. That was perfect. I love that part. Thank you, Maharaj. Whenever I come, I'm always so inspired. But one of the things, when you mentioned about how the material nature will attack us no matter what, because we're here in the material world. I was remembering a class that Srila Prabhupada gave where he said, yes, don't think that just because you're a devotee that you're not going to get attacked by the material nature. And so it's really important to arm ourselves with this chanting of Hare Krishna. It's so protective, and it gives us so much, like you were talking about, inner strength. And one example is, even Srila Prabhupada, even though he is such a pure devotee, as he's walking along after he took sannyas in Vrindavan, he was gored by a bull. So we can see how the material nature comes, no matter who you are or where you are or what you're doing. But that didn't deter him from moving forward.
Thank you very much. Profound. Madhava Govinda?
Thank you for the class, Prabhuji. I like the point where you told that how in this world everything sticks, and when we chant, the mind will say no, no, no. But at some point of time, it may stick to us in our head, and that will be the perfection. Thank you.
Yeah. It's something we've been thinking about a lot lately, because we've been going to various corporate venues around the Silicon Valley and teaching. And people are interested in meditation these days, so we've really been trying to put the science that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught within the context of meditation. And in doing that and studying something about meditation and how it's been presented historically, and it reveals a lot about the various phases of the mind, states of the mind. For instance, looking at the Yoga Sutras, which goes into a lot of detail about the various ways. There are various categories that Patanjali mentions about states of mind, and other traditions too. People who study the mind carefully will notice that it has various characteristics and way of acting. And someone who's not aware of that at all and just identifies themselves with the mind and goes along with it may then just think that it's a wild ride. Life is wild. But it's actually your mind is wild. Because as we were speaking at Google the other day, something I think adapted from Eckhart Tolle, that you have your life and then you have your life situation. And the two are different. Your life is something substantial and solid. And Krishna talks about this again and again in the Bhagavad Gita, where he explains how the body is moving and changing. Dehi no smin yata dehe kovaran yovanam jara tata dehantara praptir dhiras tatra namuyati. The body will change from boyhood to youth to old age. And you can see it going through cycles. In fact, souls have been here a long time. They're going through all these changes. And you can watch and you see, especially start to get older, and you say, oh, here we go again. It's happening again. And then death comes. It's like, here it comes again. And the soul's actually aware at some level that I really have nothing to do with this. I was stunned when my mother was passing away. I spent a lot of time with her because, she was available at that time. And one of the things she said just before she left was, she said, I never want to have to do this again. So that was really interesting, because she wasn't saying it from some religious perspective, because she had no religious tradition at all. But it was an observation from the point of the soul, who is the steady within the body. And then so Krishna says, you have to be dhira. You have to identify with that steady position. Then he says in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Kshetrajnam chapi mam vidhi sarva kshetri shubharata kshetra kshetrajnayo jnanam yattach jnanam matambama. And that is that a person who's attained knowledge is one who sees the difference between the changing body and mind and the self. So that's the life, which is steady, and the life situation, which will always be changing. And the life situation includes the situation my body is in right now. And it's always different. You see little children, they're in a particular state because of their body. And adolescents, definitely. They get hormones coursing through their veins that make them feel infallible. It's almost like, what's that? Anyway, there's drugs that make people feel like, I can jump off a roof now. And kids do that all the time. And later on, there's all these circumstances because of the present body and the present mind. But spiritual life means to be able to see the difference between the two. That's real knowledge. That's what Krishna is saying. Yattach jnana matambama. In my opinion, this is real knowledge, to see the difference between these two, the steady and the changing environment. Thank you, Madhava Govinda. Yeah, he's a spiritual scientist because he's always thinking of how to present in a concise way the science of Krishna consciousness to strangers. All of the devotees who go out, they become very well spoken, because what happens when you try to present this to others in various situations, you have to consider it very carefully, and you also have to draw from your own realizations and see how it relates to the philosophy. So it's not just dry, it's actually dynamic, what you're presenting. And it gets more consolidated in your own life when you when you practice it, and then you go attempt to teach it to other people. Because they'll ask you a lot of questions, challenging questions even. What about this? What about that? You ever thought of that? There is no God because of what about this? And then you have to go back and reprocess that. In the process of reprocessing, you actually have to dig deeper and understand through logic and also your own experience how this is real. And that's how you mature in spiritual life. Otherwise, if you stay on a superficial level, just like with chanting, if you identify with the mind while you're chanting all the time, then it you don't move forward in the process. You never get to you don't get traction. In fact, it can be disappointing because you're not actually listening to the mantra. You're listening to your mind, or you're identifying with the life situation rather than seeing how you're being sustained by a higher life, which is Krishna. And so there's a necessity for survival in spiritual life to take some time and be a little serious and process it oneself. And it helps by teaching it to others too, because they'll challenge you. Next. Yes.
Maharaj, I liked when you said rhythm is the universal language.
Rhythm is the universal language, yes.
And I was at the Harinam in Palo Alto last Friday. And I was standing in front of the book table and trying to invite. So there was an Indian gentleman, you know, in his middle 40s, well-placed. And I just called out to him to come and have a look at the books. And he was very much engrossed. He didn't even register that I was talking to him. And so many thoughts raised in my mind. I was thinking like, oh, he's from India. He's ignoring these wonderful books. He seems like a well-placed person. He must be thinking about the hundreds of projects he has to handle and things like that. And I, as I was observing him, you know, walk in front of me, in front of the book table, and he started going towards where the kirtan was happening. And I could notice a very visual difference in his approach and his demeanor. And I could see him turn his head, and I was like, okay, at least he'll hear a little bit of the mantra. And I was very surprised that he stopped there. And then he started listening to, and that was a difference, because there was rhythm over there. Yeah,
to me, it's the best perspective. It's the best seat in the house to be able to sit, you know, be participating in this, in the kirtan, and then watch transformation as people walk by. And just, it's interesting to notice people's countenances because it's so expressive of their inner workings. People's, you see, the mind is the index of, the face is the index of the mind. And you'll notice how people, when they're exposed to various kinds of vibrations and so forth, change. And so it's noticeable when people come in contact with the vibration of the Hare Krishna chanting, how they change. It's practically inexplicable. Like if you were trying to write down adjectives to describe what people's faces look like, it's not so easy because they're a little bit generalized. I mean, some people, like there's a devotee in Alachua, Florida, really brilliant devotee, the daughter of who is it? Fundraising for the COVP? Radhajivan's daughter. She's a world-class artist. What is her name? Yeah, Rukmini Priya. Super brilliant. All his kids are, but I saw some of her artwork where she was painting pictures of emotions. You know, did you see that? It's really good, isn't it? I mean, it's brilliant. And so she was showing these pictures she studied art, and she's also talented. So she was showing the various images, not just like emojis, like we see, but very subtle differences in people's moods. And she made a whole book about it. So it's part of being a sentient being. We have all these a spectrum of emotions that can come out. And they're expressed through the countenance, through our body language, through our face, and so forth. And artists who are very astute can bring those out and represent them. So we can see. And so part of the experience of Sankirtan, that is going out into public and making the vibration, is being perceptive of the changes that take place in people's countenances, and you watch them, and we can intuit what's happening. I mean, you can't speculate and be exactly correct every time, but you start to get a general impression of the effect of the vibration. And what's important about that is that when you see that, then you also think, boy, they're actually getting more than I am sometimes. And you feel, oh, let me go deeper into this. That's why the participation in Sankirtan and participation amongst those who are interested in it and also those who aren't interested in it. And sometimes the reaction when people are averse to it is even more profound. I just think, why is it so repelling? What's repugnant about it anyway? What is it? You have to think about, why would somebody object to people chanting? And especially if they can identify it as names of God, why would somebody go like, get away, I don't want to hear it. What's that all about? So there's always some feedback from the environment, and that information loop, sorry, so to speak, is really kind of helpful in edifying oneself, and one's own perspective of spiritual life. Realization thickens in that way. What else you got out there? Yes. Here comes a mic from Harinam. He wants it bad too, I can tell.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
What I heard a devotee once say about people who respond, I sometimes say to myself, they're bitten by a snake. When I sometimes approach someone with a book, they jump, and they're just like, no. And so it's actually a sign of love. And a devotee once explained to me that in a household, when dad is watching the football game and his daughter gets in the way, he'll be very ferocious, just get out of my way. You know, he'll be very strong because he loves her a lot. But he's just, you know, he's involved in something. So there's a lot of love there. And then out of that love, there's some you know, ferocious taste in that case for, you know, for the football game. So the response of no, and the very strong emotional response is actually a sign of love that people do have deep in their heart for the Lord.
What a compassionate soul to have walking around Silicon Valley. Now I see why Navina brought you in here, special ops. Turn Harinam loose on Silicon Valley. That's really nice. Thank you very much. What happened to Avanti? Is she here? Oh, okay. So I'm going to read a few verses to get a sense for the poetry. Now, I did advertise multiple things, so I'll just mention them briefly if I actually have anything else. But, I was mentioning chanting, so I went about it in kind of a general way, but here's an experiment that everyone can try in this day and age that's really interesting. And that is that when you start your chanting, or before you start your chanting, try this. And it may be an extensive list. Try turning off anything in your environment that might cause a distraction. It's so, the intentionality behind doing that is so profound that immediately your mind will become more focused. This is modern meditation, by the way. If you just do that one thing, the way in which you're able to chant and pray will become profoundly different. And that includes letting everybody know that somebody mentioned this term to me the other day. It's called going dark. Actually, I read it in a book. Have you ever heard this? Sometimes engineers go dark. They're working on something that's so, right? Engineers, this, at least what I read in the book, sometimes they're so absorbed in coding that they can't miss a line or any one of the symbols, and they have complete concentration, so they go dark. No one can find them for 3-4 days. There's no way to get in touch with them at all. And also, sometimes fugitives they'll do that. Or people who just hate the government, they'll also do that too. I've heard experiments where people say, I don't want anybody following me. I'm not keeping a cell phone. I don't want any accounts anywhere. I'm not giving my social security number. In fact, I don't even want one. I'm using cash. You know, this is going dark, right? Going off the grid. Go off the grid, go dark. And so if you try this before you chant and pray, go dark. Tell your spouse, tell your dog. It's like, I ain't talking to you. And it's like, nope. No biscuits, nothing. And everybody knows. In fact, one thing I discovered a long time ago when I travel is I carry a do not disturb sign with me. And it's like the intention of putting it up on the door. Everyone's like, wow, do not disturb. But for me, it really helps because I know there's a barrier there. And if you turn off everything that has a switch that could go on, you know, just like it probably won't, no, it probably will. But even if you know it won't, turn it off anyway. Make yourself dead to the world. And that kind of silence is really important for this human psyche. We don't get it very often. In fact, there's a way in which I'm bombarded from moment to moment. I don't even know it. Experiments show that if you put a frog into a lukewarm water and then you heat it up gradually, that he won't even notice until it's too hot and then it's too late. That's all I'm going to say about it. And if you put him into something that's too hot, he'll just jump right out. So I may have become so accustomed to distraction that I'm tormented by it, but I don't even know it. And not only that, I may have psychological problems, or I should say psychological, you know, contortions that are bothering me. And I can't tell where they're coming from. I go to the doctor and says, well, here, take some of these. And that makes it worse. It just covers the problem. But where is it coming from? Unless it's, you know, an acute clinical problem, it's always possible. And that has to be looked into. But there's a way in which my overall exposure to too much, too many choices, too many sounds, too many lights can actually overwhelm my senses, and I'll lose my peace of mind for a long time. So we actually need, as human beings, a little solitude. In fact, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that you should live alone. You go to a sacred place and live alone. Just go out in the forest, be alone. And so at least every day, you should take some time alone to turn everything off so nothing can get to you. So this is a part of the meditation that you can do in the morning. If you want to do a ritual, you start turning everything off. What are you doing? It's a religious ritual. This is my ritual. I turn everything off. This is my statement to the world. This is my resistance against the material energy. I refuse to consume what this material energy is feeding me in Kali Yuga. I'm not taking it anymore. I'm turning it off. And if you do it deliberately every day for a set amount of time, and then you sit down in that environment and you repeat the names of the Supreme, and remember that you're making a direct connection to the Supreme by mentioning his name. This is part of the philosophy I didn't mention. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that when you utter the name of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you have direct communion with him. Not in the future, but immediately. And there's no difference at all, he said, between the Supreme Lord and his name. And so if someone can perceive that, even for a fraction of a second, that person will, the countenance will change. Your biorhythms will change within that second. The cells in your brain will be rearranged by that experience in that one fleeting second, fraction of a second of experiencing that. You'll have seen something so profound that you'll never be the same ever again. And you'll be able to deal with the world in a more measured ways. Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janayat Yashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayat Haitukam Srimad Bhagavatam says, by the direct process of bhakti, which means specifically by connecting through hearing the divine names and the Srimad Bhagavatam, then you naturally get knowledge and detachment from the world, which is something you can't buy anywhere else in the world. You can't buy it even if you have billions of dollars. An impossible substance to find. It has to be produced from this confluence of sincerity and practice of the authorized process of chanting the Krishna's names. So that's an idea. That's practical, isn't it? That's something that anybody can do or not do. I mean, not do meaning you cannot listen to all the stuff. And if you decide not to, it becomes so demonstrative to your own mind and senses that we're not doing this now. Then the mind starts to ask the question, well, then what are we going to do? Because that's a reasonable question to ask, because the mind always wants something to do, because it's like a little monkey. The monkeys in Vrindavan, most of you who have been there, all of you who have been there are familiar with, because they are so prominent in their whimsy that they go out of their way to display it to the world of how what the very definition of whimsy is. It's like breaking stuff for no reason. And the mind is like that. And then I've heard also, if you get one of those little monkeys and you got them drunk, like they got a hold of one of those bottles, I've seen it advertised on the freeway in Delhi. Not that you need to drink anything when you're on the freeway or anywhere else, but they have this liquor called Bagpiper. I see advertised Bagpiper liquid. It's like, God, what is in that? But if a monkey got a hold of that and started drinking, and then you let him loose, then you got a super problem. So the mind is like a drunken monkey. And how are you going to deal with that? Well, that's one of the subjects of the Bhagavad Gita. That's yoga, how to deal with the mind. So if you turn everything off and you give yourself a break from that for a little while, and even if it's for 10 minutes, Bhagavatam says, it's possible to go a whole lifetime of never even getting one moment of clarity, of intentional clarity, of actually introspection. You could actually go from pillar to post. You could be born, come out, go through the whole childhood distracted, listening to everybody telling you all this stuff. You got to learn this, you got to learn that, you got to get ready for college, blah, blah, blah. And then you keep going through. Then you get into college. Everyone says you got to get ready for this. Next thing, you got to get ready for family life. Family life, you got to get ready for retirement. Retirement says you got to get ready to die. You know, get your papers in order. And next thing you know, you're dying. It's like, wait a minute. I didn't take even a moment for myself. I didn't have one second of clarity in my whole life. So Bhagavatam says, better you get 1 second of clarity in your life than you live your whole life and you perfect it according to the status quo. And everyone thinks, well, you did such a great job. That's a good sound because that means the harmonium's coming out. I did promise one verse, so this verse is from text 245 in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. Let's just listen to it, because this is one of the other processes for feeding the soul. There are beautiful poetical verses throughout the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, and if all you do is take a quota every day of time and you read some of them, your mind will become satisfied, because the mind needs a little beauty. It needs some aesthetic satisfaction. And this is like music for the mind and soul to hear these verses. And if you can learn Sanskrit, or at least how to pronounce it, then you also get that aesthetic sense, and you can go through the verses. So this verse, 245, let's read the translation. If after you have seen the 2 lotus feet of Sri Ram, your hankering to see your Lord is unappeased, then Ram, whose heart is soft from overflowing compassion, will happily send you to Dwarka. Actually, this is kind of interesting. Let's do a little more. Text 46, 246. While going there, perform the Lord's Sankirtan as it has been described, and you will finally see your own dear Lord, whom you have so long desired to see, the charming Sri Krishna Chandra, surrounded by the Yadus. Commentary. Narada now further assures Gopa Kumar that Krishna in Dwarka is the same Madan Gopal he has so long been striving to find. The question is not whether Dwarka is the place to go, but only how to get there as soon as possible. That question Narada also answers here. Gopa Kumar should perform Sankirtan of Sri Krishna Chandra loudly and melodiously, singing his names, reciting his glories, and offering him prayers. How to do all this is presented systematically in the Vedic literature, and Gopa Kumar should not wonder how to recognize his worshipable Lord upon seeing him, because the Lord, the devotee's eternal master, will not keep his glories hidden forever from his dependent. That's good to know, isn't it? Or alternatively, it may be that Narada is advising Gopa Kumar to follow the Raghunuga method of devotional service by listening to the dictates of his heart rather than mechanically following the injunctions of scripture. In any case, the Supreme Lord is all-powerful, so one way or another, devotees who perform Sankirtan of the Lord's names will easily realize all of their ambitions. Ayodhya, Dwarka, and other such abodes are all regions of Vaikuntha. Surely, therefore, you need not take permission from the Lord of Vaikuntha to leave and go there. Kosala, Ayodhya, Dwarka, everyone say Kosala. Ayodhya, Dwarka. Thank you. And other exalted abodes like Lord Jagannath's Purushottam Kshetra all belong to the greater kingdom of Vaikuntha. Since Gopa Kumar is not planning to go outside, he does not need special permission from Lord Narayan. By his order, I have come here to see you. He knows the movements of everyone's heart, and you should know that from my mouth you have received his order. Purport. Even though Gopa Kumar's journey would not take him outside Vaikuntha, he may have wanted to confirm with Lord Narayan that this travel was proper. Earlier, however, Lord Narayan had requested Narada, please meet Gopa Kumar in a private place and fulfill all his desires. So Lord Narayan knows the inner workings of everyone's heart. He had known that Gopa Kumar had been dissatisfied even with living in Vaikuntha. And so he had sent Narada to encourage Gopa Kumar to move on. In any case, the Lord has gone somewhere to bestow his favor on one of his great devotees. Since you will be unable to tolerate having to wait for him, now is the best time for you to go. Commentary. Gopa Kumar might accept everything Narada has told him, but still wonder why he shouldn't meet the Lord in person before departing. Gopa Kumar's devotional mood might inspire him to ask such a question. Anticipating this possibility, Narada informs him that Lord Narayan has gone out of Vaikuntha for a while to visit some favorite devotee. But I just saw him here, Gopa Kumar might contend. Yes, but he left just now. You came to this spot before he went away. But he should come back soon. I can wait till then. No, I don't think you have the patience to wait until he returns. In other words, it is likely that Lord Narayan, out of compassion for the great devotee he is visiting, will agree to stay with that devotee for some time. And Gopa Kumar is so eager to achieve his goal that he will be unable to tolerate even a moment's delay. Gopa Kumar need not lament over being unable to take permission from Lord Narayan in person. Since the Lord is absent and has already given his permission, this is the best opportunity to leave Vaikuntha. If Gopa Kumar waits to consult him in person, seeing Lord Narayan will destroy the desire to go, and he will not achieve his goal. The Lord himself made the current arrangements with all these considerations in mind. Sri Gopa Kumar said, overjoyed at hearing this, I bowed down repeatedly to Sri Narada, took his blessings, and set out remembering his instructions. Commentary. After leaving for Ayodhya, Gopa Kumar followed Narada's instructions about remembering Lord Ramachandra's glories by chanting O husband of Sita, Raghunath, elder brother of Lakshmana, O Lord, dear master of Sri Hanuman. After traveling a long way, I saw some forest monkeys restlessly jumping here and there and shouting, Ram, Ram!
Ram, Ram!
As I moved forward, they gathered around me and tried to grab my flute from my hand. Then I saw some humans who were even more beautiful than the associates of the Lord of Vaikuntha. Commentary, those monkeys were grabbing at Gopakumar's flute either because they could not bear someone's being a devotee of anyone other than Lord Sri Raghunath, or because they were extremely attracted to the flute. After Gopakumar walked a short distance with the monkeys, he saw some human associates of Lord Ramachandra. They appeared more beautiful than any other servants of the Lord he had ever seen, including the four-handed residents of Vaikuntha, who were blessed with the perfection of Sarupya, having bodily forms like that of Sri Narayan. Those men, in behavior like the best of civilized persons, could not tolerate my bowing down to them and showing other signs of respect. They brought me to the outer boundary of their city and through an entrance gate. Both the humans and the monkeys escorted Gopakumar into Lord Ramachandra's city. When they reached the gateway, Gopakumar was so overwhelmed with ecstasy from seeing these associates of the Lord that he could not enter on his own strength, but only with their help. Lord Ramachandra must have sent these devotees out of the city to meet Gopakumar, because without the Lord's order, such devotees exclusively dedicated to the rasa found at his lotus feet would never have ventured so far away. Gopakumar could not behave with the men he saw the same way as with the residents of Vaikuntha, because these devotees of Lord Ramachandra did not allow him to show any respect. They were just like the best of Aryans in their behavior, very modest and considerate to everyone. Indeed, the civilized Aryans have learned many of their standards of conduct from the devotees of Lord Ram. Devotees of Lord Ram ki?
Jai!
Therefore, before me I saw Bharat with Shatrughna, seated comfortably with monkeys like Sugriva, Angada, and Jambavan, and surrounded by many handsome men. Thinking Bharat to be Ramachandra, Lord of the Raghus, I recited prayers addressed to that Lord, but Bharata covered his ears and repeatedly forbade me to continue, saying, I am only a servant. No, but you gotta cover your ears. I'm only So you can try that as homework today. If anybody says anything to you, you go, I'm only a servant. Gopakumar greeted Bharata with prayers suitable for Lord Ramachandra. All glories to you, great king, emperor of all emperors, Sri Raghavendra, darling of Janaki. Bharata was shocked to hear such praise. He covered both ears with his hands and exclaimed, I am just his servant. Because Lord Bharata was sitting in a fabulous royal palace on a divine lion throne, attended by many principal servants of Lord Ramachandra and by other residents of Ayodhya, it was easy for Gopakumar to mistake Lord Bharat for Lord Ram. Moreover, Bharata's beauty and dress were just like Ram's, and because Bharata is a plenary portion of the personality of Godhead, his wife is a plenary portion of the goddess Lakshmi. So she appeared just like Mother Sita, and Shatrughna, who stood by Bharata's throne, looked not much different from Lakshmana. Everyone okay? Afraid, I stood motionless before Lord Bharata with joined palms. Hanuman then quickly made me leave that place and enter the inner precincts of the city, where I saw the most amazing sight, the Supreme Lord in his form as the best of human beings. He sat comfortably on a royal throne in the best of palaces, a palace full of all charming attractions. Happy and marked with all the signs of a great personage, he seemed somewhat like Lord Narayan. Commentary. Lord Ramachandra's face beamed with satisfaction, and his body showed all the marks of a perfect person that are set forth in scripture, such as an expansive chest, a neck like a bull's, and mighty arms as broad as the trunk of a shal tree. His youthfulness, his ornaments, and the exquisite shape of his limbs made him look much like the Lord of Vaikuntha. But certain especially attractive features distinguish him from that Lord. His hand was adorned with a bow. His glances were delightfully modest and humble. Playing the role of a perfect king, he followed all the prescribed rules of religious behavior. Lord Ramachandra is even more beautifully attractive than Lord Narayan. He has two arms, he is the best of bowmen, and in his unique way, he is the best protector of the citizens of his kingdom. He strictly adheres to the Vedic principles of civilized conduct. I was bewildered by the overflowing ecstasy of his darshan, and I fell down before him as if offering prostrate obeisances. My confusion thus robbed me of the supreme benefit of seeing him. But then, by his mercy, I was able to stand up again and see him clearly. The personality of God, it is the supreme goal in all endeavors of human existence, since even in the most sublime endeavor of pure devotion, he is the goal. He awards such devotion to his surrendered devotees. Sri Hanuman left me, pulled back by his own regular service, and in a single jump went to join his Lord. On the left of the Lord, pleasing him with her service, stood his dear counterpart Sita, and on his other side, his younger brother Lakshmana. Leaving Gopakumar at the very spot where he had fallen to the ground, Hanuman went to the side of Lord Ramachandra by jumping as monkeys generally do. Hanuman was drawn back to his Lord's side by the ecstatic attraction of eternal service. His desire above all was to do whatever would give his Lord the most pleasure. Although the sight of Lord Ramachandra is naturally blissful, when he is with his beloved Janaki, with Lakshmana, and with his best servant Hanuman, his beauty increases manyfold, and whoever sees him becomes immersed in the most exceptional ecstasy. This picture of Lord Ramachandra together with Sita, Lakshmana, and Hanuman depicts the Supreme Lord in his especially compassionate mood of reciprocating with his intimate servants. Sita Devi in particular is the perfectly compatible consort for Lord Ramachandra, and her beauty and other qualities excel even those of the goddess Lakshmi in Vaikuntha. Standing on the left side of the Lord, she displays such pastimes as offering him betel nut to chew. Two more verses. Sri Hanuman sometimes stood in front of the Lord, fanning him with excellent white chamras and singing his glories, and sometimes, palms joined, he praised the Lord with wonderful prayers of his own composition. At one moment he carried a white umbrella, at another he massaged the Lord's lotus feet, and yet another he did several kinds of service all at once. Amazingly, he was not in the least fatigued by all of this. Commentary: Gopakumar saw Hanuman render several services at once, singing Lord Ramachandra's glories, fanning the Lord, reciting famous prayers, massaging his feet, and much more. And even such simultaneous expenditures of energy didn't seem to tire Hanuman at all. So this is from the Sri Brihat Bhagavatamrita, a seminal book of Gaudiya Vaishnavism written by Srila Sanatan Goswami, which, by the way, has just been reprinted and will be available in America in a paperback edition, which will be drastically less expensive than the first rendition, which I think was like $40 per volume. I think the full set will be under $20 when it finally arrives, which is very soon. It's on a boat now. And by reading from these various books, one gets an image of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which is absolutely necessary to quell the onslaught of desires to enjoy the variety of the material world. Yene ravindaksha vimuktamaninas tvayasta bhava davashudha buddhaya aruya krishna paramparam tata patantyato nadrita yushmarangrayaha. The Srimad Bhagavatam says, unless one can develop a relationship with the lotus-eyed Supreme Personality of Godhead, what other types of liberation one achieves will be short-lived. One will again be attracted to the variety of the material world. So hearing about Krishna from the Srimad Bhagavatam, from the summary of the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam called Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, from this Brihat Bhagavatamrita and so on, is a necessary part of the diet of one who wants to advance on the path of bhakti. Fortunately, however, all these books are readily available. Not only are they readily available, but devotees, especially here at ISV and some other major communities around the world, make it their main business to go out and make them available to people in their own homes. That's pretty nice, don't you think?
Yes.
I think so. It's a nice service.
Thank you very much, everyone, for coming here to ISKCON of Silicon Valley. This is a very special gathering today. I feel very privileged and blessed to be with you. And I'm just getting ready to go to Japan, so it's especially bittersweet that I'll miss you for a few weeks. And I'll be counting the days and moments till I get back, and we can go on with the vibration. Hare Krishna. Gaur Premanande Hari Bol.
Marman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, hey, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.